tonight on America First. The message coming out of New York City is loud and clear and impossible to ignore. After the latest election results, many within the Democratic Party are no longer simply embracing progressive policies. They appear to be moving even further left. Policies once considered politically dangerous are now becoming mainstream talking points. Government-run health care, massive wealth redistribution, expanded entitlement programs, higher taxes on businesses and high earners, greater federal control over housing, education, and energy. And increasingly, Americans are hearing a word many thought disappeared decades ago, socialism. But here is the question tonight. Is this the future of the Democratic Party? And if Democrats continue embracing more socialistic policies, is that a winning strategy politically? Or are they moving so far left they risk alienating everyday Americans? So tonight, we ask whether the Democratic Party is evolving or whether it is walking directly into a political trap. I'm Scotty Neal Hughes, and this is America First. Welcome to America First. I'm Scotty Neal Hughes. You know, American politics has always moved in cycles. One election reshapes the priorities. One movement, well, it can change the national conversation. And sometimes a single city becomes a testing ground for ideas that eventually spread nationwide. Now, for years, New York City has served as something of a political laboratory for the American left. Policies first embraced there often find their way into national Democratic policies not long afterwards. But after the latest election results, something appears to be happening inside the Democratic Party that should get every single person's attention. Progressivism may no longer be enough. Increasingly, voices on the left are openly embracing policies that move well beyond traditional liberalism and much closer to outright socialism. Gosh, those isms get me every single time. Maybe it's because it means there's more government spending, there's greater economic redistribution, and there's expanding entitlement programs. There's growing hostility toward private enterprise. There's increased federal involvement in nearly every aspect of American life. And while many progressives, well, they argue these policies create fairness, economic equality, critics argue history has shown something extremely different. So when government grows too large, individual freedoms, guess what shrinks? Them. And innovation slows, economic opportunity suffers, and eventually dependence on government replaces personal responsibility. But politically, Democrats appear increasingly comfortable with actually taking that risk. And that raises this fascinating question. Are Democrats reading the political landscape correctly? Are younger voters truly embracing a more socialist vision of America? Or are party leaders misreading activist enthusiasm as broad national support? Because while New York may move these policies politically, America is much larger than New York City. And history suggests what energizes urban progressive voters doesn't always resonate with suburban families, working-class Americans, and of course, middle-income voters simply trying to keep up with inflation and rising costs. So tonight, we're going to examine whether Democrats are making a strategic political calculation or a dangerous mistake. Joining me tonight are two guests who understand the political and economic consequences of this shift. First, Kazin, an independent commentator, and second, Jose Vega, who is an independent congressional candidate for New York's 15th district. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a very obvious question. I'm going to go with you, Jose, since I introduced you second. For decades, American politics largely operated somewhere near the center. Even when parties disagreed, there were limits to how far left of right either side could risk and move without risking this broad public backlash. But now, I think after these recent election results that we're seeing in New York City, it seems that Democrats are becoming increasingly comfortable embracing policies openly rooted in socialist ideology. So is the Democratic Party officially moving beyond traditional liberalism and embracing socialism as its long-term political identity?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the people that voted for these candidates in New York City, we're talking about Daria Liza, Claire Valdez, and yes, even Brad Lander, aren't people who are card-carrying Communist Party members, aren't even reading Marx. I would be surprised if the majority of them, you know, knew anything beyond Marx. I think a lot of these people voted for these candidates because it was a rejection of where the United States was going as a whole. You know, for the last 50 years, we've been going into deindustrialization. We've been prioritizing the wealthy over the poor people. And I think that there's a sort of misconception where a lot of people nowadays say big government means socialism, when that's just not true. You know, there was something called the American System of Economics, as was invented by Alexander Hamilton, which was implemented by Lincoln, and FDR used that American system to pull us out of the Great Depression. You know, there are policies that are actually American, where the idea is that the American government is supposed to take care of the general welfare. That's not socialist. That's actually an American idea. And that is what's actually taking center stage now. The idea that your government should work for you and not some corporation, that is what won on Tuesday.
Interesting. Kazan, how do you see this? Because if that is true, do you think this is a carefully calculated strategy, or do you think this is a dangerous overcorrection for the Democratic Party to make?
So I actually don't think this is something that's being catalyzed by the entire Democratic Party. I think what is a helpful framework for thinking about political parties in general is their factions, right? So you have the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, you have the more moderate wing. And I think what you're seeing now is a progressive wing getting more share of voice in the party. And I think it's important to look at why in the first place. So I agree with Jose that it's essentially, it's not as ideological as people are portraying it. It's more of a grievance that a lot of people in America are expressing with being able to pay for a house in the future, unable to start a family, feeling like the American dream is slipping away. And I think for a lot of people, it's really not that deep. They just want a solution. And the modern Democratic Party hasn't been able to provide people with a positive vision of the future. And I think what you're seeing with the Democratic Socialists is, even if you disagree with their policies and fundamental worldview, at least they have a worldview. And I don't think the Democrats have had a worldview pretty much since 2023, at least. So what you're seeing right now is a very animated faction of a Democratic Party that has a clear vision and is very organized in the Democratic Socialists of America, accumulating share of voice because they're going somewhere and people like that.
But Kazan, I want to stick with you on this one, because when you talk about that worldview, when I talk to Republicans, that's what's getting the Republicans in trouble, is their worldview. It's not necessarily their domestic issues that are disenfranchising their base. It's their worldview. It's the endless wars. It's the never-ending wars. It's the getting involved in areas that don't necessarily directly affect the United States. It's those America First folks that are like, why are we in 8 different countries right now that have nothing to do with us, either national security or economics? So when you say it's the worldview, does that really going to be a winning token for Democrats, is to focus on a world strategy, necessarily not what's going on here at home?
Oh, so when I say worldview, I'm not talking about foreign policy. I'm talking about a general strategy for how to run the country and a vision for what the country will look like when you get to the end. And I don't think the Democrats have had a real view. I think what was appealing about MAGA for a lot of people, and even outside of the Republican Party, because I think MAGA kind of subsumed the Republican Party, was that Trump had a vision. He said, hey, we're going to make America great, and here's what it looks like. Now you're seeing kind of an equal and opposite reaction from the left, where it's a very different vision of what America should look like, but it is a vision. So personally, I'm not a huge fan of radicalism in any direction. I don't think we need it. I think what we need is a national conversation that's just not happening between the right and the left. And as a result, we're in these algorithmic echo chambers that just keep getting more and more extreme. But yeah, to me, this is not even necessarily about foreign policy. It's more about people feeling like, hey, I have a clear problem. I don't see my problems being solved under the moderates and the people from the establishment, so I'm willing to look elsewhere. And I think particularly for Gen Z and millennials. People are feeling this because if you're a Gen Z or a millennial, you know, you're a 20-year-old kid and you look at the price of housing. You know, I used to live in LA. It's like $1 million to get a house. Of course, you're going to look for an alternative. And it's not enough to just be constantly told, hey, this ideology doesn't work for XYZ reasons. As Jose mentioned, most of the people, they haven't read Marx. It's not that deep for them. Right. They just want something that is different than what they're experiencing.
Jose, what are you seeing? Because are Democrats simply responding, like you said, to this legitimate frustration from younger voters? Or do you think it's there? Do you think Democrats are actually exploiting this economic anxiety to justify expanding this government power far beyond what Americans historically accepted? And they're taking advantage of the fact that we're out of money, that most in this generation are completely broke and would like to actually live the American dream in some form.
Well, take it like this. Claire Valdez, one of the winners from Tuesday night, was asked, what do you think about the relationship between Israel and the United States? And she said, I just think that we should prioritize our people here at home before we talk about giving any kind of foreign aid to any other country. Who else was spouting that same message? Donald Trump. In 2024, he ran on an explicitly anti-war campaign. He was ridiculing the fact that Kamala Harris was campaigning with Liz Cheney. You know, a lot of people thought, oh, wait a minute, this might be the end to the endless wars. This might be a real economic revival. That's what Trump won on. And I really want to make that clear to people that what the candidates were running on, you know, that they were saying, we're going to make sure everybody gets affordable housing, we're going to end all the wars, we're going to make sure people are taken care of. That's what Trump was saying in 2024, and that's why he won. And a lot of people feel betrayed, and they see that. But they see it in both parties, because there's something happening nationally. It's not just happening in New York City. You actually see the same expression with Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who have both said they're leaving the Republican Party. They're not Democrats. They're not too sure what to do. But there's a wave happening right now where many Americans feel that exact same way. The Democratic Party doesn't speak for them. The Republican Party doesn't speak for them. And so we saw that manifested on Tuesday night with these candidates, and we're going to see further expressions of it.
But Jose, is that socialism or is it populism? Is it populism that's actually spanning both ideologies, political ideologies?
You know, I wish it was socialism, because if it was, Wall Street wouldn't be standing here. You know, the bankers would be in jail. You know, this is completely like I wish it was socialism. It's milk toast, you know. There's a lot of people that need to be held responsible for the economic downfall of the United States, for putting people in impoverished conditions, for completely destroying neighborhoods and this benign neglect. You know, frankly, I think it's more reactionary than anything else, and maybe you could describe it populist, and I think it's time that we inject some real solutions. Who's talking about rebuilding the United States? Who's talking about bringing high-speed rail to the United States? Nuclear power plants. Let's start that conversation now. Development. Build new cities. Now, that's the kind of politics I'd like to start talking about.
Well, that's what we will talk about, Kazen and Jose, when we get right back. So stay right here with us. Because when we do come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Because if Democrats continue embracing socialist policies, I have to ask, could they actually be helping Republicans politically? Or do you think America's fundamentally changed enough that government expansion is now becoming the new political normal? Stay with us. You're watching America First. Welcome back. Tonight, we are examining whether the Democratic Party's growing embrace of socialist policies actually represents the future of American politics, or whether it may ultimately create a backlash voters will reject. Joining me again, let's continue with our conversation, Kazen Asiadu, independent commentator, and Jose Vega, who is independent congressional candidate for New York's 15th district. Good gracious. God bless you for running. I don't care what party you belong to. Goodness, it's become such an interesting political world that we are today. It's surprising that anybody would want to run for office, especially if they have a good soul about them. Kazen, I want to start with you, because we can talk about all these policies, and one of you brought up what happened back, getting us out of the Depression and the government stepping in. But we are trillions of dollars in debt. So how can the government help pay anymore when the past transgressions have caused today for us to be trillions of dollars in debt? How can the government pay for anything else?
Yeah, so first, just to clarify how my name is pronounced, because I know it's a really difficult name. It's Kazen Asiadu. So I don't blame anyone for not getting it. It's really complicated.
Thank you.
Now, so a point on, like, look, I think what the socialists are correct about is what the problems are, right? Like, when people can't afford a home, when people are afraid that any kind of upward social or economic mobility is slipping out of reach, of course, that needs to be spoken to. And I think the socialists are very articulate about that. Here's why I diverge. It's on the solutions. I don't think the issue is that the government's not doing enough. I think the issue is that the government has been hijacked by moneyed and corporate interests that are causing it to not serve the people and instead serve people's profits. And I don't think the socialists have the solution, but I think they introduce some tension into a system that actually does need some tension. Because if we're being honest, part of the problem here is that when we talk about housing, for example, we have all these laws that are in place that are benefiting institutional investors and the ability for people to buy up more than 350 homes in an area and drive up the cost of homes for the average person. Or we have all these banks that are giving $100,000, $200,000 loans to college students to get a liberal arts degree that they have no prospect of paying off in the future, right? So we have this credit-driven, renter-driven economy where the average American is basically trapped in someone else's P&L, and the government is not doing what it's supposed to, which is focusing on the people and serving as many people as possible, as opposed to who has as many profits as possible. So I think that's the actual issue. Not that the government needs more money, right? So when I hear stuff like, oh, we need to tax the billionaires, well, if you're saying you need to tax the billionaires, where do the taxes go? The government. Do you think the government has done a good job with the trillions of dollars it already has? I don't think so. And I'm not interested in giving the government more money. I'm interested in having smarter laws that are not influenced by whatever lobby is talking to my local congressman and speaking into his ear rather than him having the ear of the people. So that's what I think the actual issue is. And hopefully, you know, you talked about, is it socialism or populism? I think that's a healthy form of populism, just saying, hey, our government is not working for us. But I think what we do overcorrect is by saying, well, the government's not working, so let's give the government more money. It's more good money in after bad. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Do you know what's funny, though? As you're sitting there talking, it's reminding me of every speech that I heard this past weekend on the campaign trail from everybody who's running for senator down to dog catcher in the local area. They all have that same exact speech. But it's funny because once they're elected, regardless if they have an R or a D by their name, they're not really speaking those same terms. More importantly, they're not following through on what they're saying. Jose, I want to bring in this conversation because Republicans, they're kind of looking at what happened in New York and they're thinking, are Democrats moving further left? Could this actually be an enormous political opportunity? Because they're also screaming, socialist has become that S word, has become a curse word in Republicans. In fact, it's a red meat word, socialism, communism. It's all one and the same. They push it together. So do you think what is happening in New York, do you see it as a bigger picture for the ideology of the Democratic Party? Or is it more going to be what Republicans use to push against and take advantage of just even just the use of the word? And are Democrats basically handing them the win for the future just by because of a word they choose?
Well, you know, the word itself, socialism, communism, will in fact play in some of the more conservative southern states. But, you know, ultimately what we have to see is solutions. You know, I do agree on the point that these socialists who are getting elected don't have real tangible solutions. I mean, I agree with the policy that we do need Medicare for all, that we do need to make things more affordable. The question is, how do you actually get there, right? And that is where the difference will be on who actually wins back the House in November, because you can say these things, but if you don't actually have a viable plan going there, then the Republicans will, in fact, capitalize on that. You know, personally, what I think that they should be doing is they should be talking about restructuring the debt. A lot of the debt that we have in the United States is just speculative. It's unproductive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually go to anything. I'm not against debt in general, as long as it's being used productively. You know, for example, if we were to pull out a $500 billion loan, but that $500 billion is supposed to be used for high-speed rail, well, that's fine with me, because that eventually that debt will be paid off, and it's being used for productive purposes, right? Or if you're, instead of bailing out banks, you know, with trillions of dollars, if you're investing $1 trillion of that towards Medicare for all so that people can walk into a doctor office or a hospital and not worry about a medical bill, or, for example, reviving our productive capabilities. There was a time where here in the poorest congressional district in the entire country, which is in New York City, 2 miles away from Wall Street, right, you had one factory producing 50,000 metric tons of steel. Nowadays, the condition condition in this district is so bad that people who live in apartments here in the Bronx, 80% of their income is used just to pay their rent. And that's like the median situation per household. So if you're making roughly $60,000 a year, you're most 81% of these people, if they're making $60,000, $48,000 goes to their rent. It's unlivable. People are living in wage slave conditions, and we need to bring back production as a solution that these democratic socialists need to start saying, let's, you know, bring back the factories, let's bring back city building, and let's bring back productivity. That's what can win them the House in the midterms.
Once again, though, there's a difference between winning, because the ones that talk, and actually putting it into action. Are both parties guilty? And are the people that are elected with those R's and the D's by their names, aren't they both guilty of having the opportunity to change it? A very easy solution. Like you said, both of you have come up with great solutions to problems that make have common sense involved. And yet, Washington, D.C. never gets that done. If anything, the laws that they pass only complicate it more. Isn't that a part of our issue in this, Kazeem?
I think it is, and I think there's just too much money in politics. Yeah. Look, the you know, when people talk about the Uniparty, it's real. And I don't think it's that there's this, you know, this secret cabal of people trying to control America and ruin the lives of every people. I think it's just poor incentive alignment. At the end of the day, if you have a lobbyist who has tens of millions of dollars behind them and they can fund the whole congressional race for a Republican, it doesn't matter if they're a Republican or a Democrat, they're going to be influenced by that person. And that's a problem. Money has become louder than people's voices, and it distorts incentives. And if you're a congressperson, at some level, I kind of don't blame them. I blame the system that we've created here, where everyone's on a short-term popularity contest, where the only goal is to get elected again. And the way that you get elected again is by having enough money to fund an expensive media campaign. I mean, you look at both sides. Both sides had billionaires in this last election. How many billions of dollars were collectively spent on the Trump versus Kamala race? It's ridiculous. So the deeper problem here is that the politics is disconnected from the interests of the people and is more responsive to the interests of corporations. We need to get money out of politics, and it doesn't need to be like this. Like, if you think of Citizens United, and basically the conclusion of Citizens United was, hey, money is a form of speech, and we're not going to limit people's speech. It's like, yeah, I guess it makes sense on paper. But in reality, what happens is that someone who has $1 million has more influence and more of a voice than someone who's making 60K a year in the Bronx and is actually suffering and is spending 81% of their rent of money on rent. That's the actual problem. We have incentive misalignment.
Jose, I know you feel this pain right now, having run for office. You understand the fact that the way you get the money is you have to make the agreement. You sell your soul. The question is, who are you selling your soul to? Are you going north or are you going south? And that's what, how this is in politics. But it's one thing, we can all say these same things, and we've been saying them for over a decade, talking about campaign finance reform, budget. Once again, it's kind of like term limits. You are asking the wolf in the hen house to become a vegetarian. It's not going to happen. So, Jose, in our last few minutes that we have together, give me a solution. I heard Kazeem's solution, and it makes sense if we could get some good politicians in to actually implement it. What is your solution onto this, Jose, especially for the Democratic Party or for just the country?
Yeah, well, I think for one, it's people do need to abandon the Democrat Republican label and jump on the idea that there's a third force emerging in the country. And when I say third force, I don't mean third party. I mean people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey on the Republican side who have been shunned by their own party simply because of their outspokenness on the spending with foreign countries and because they were pivotal in exposing the Epstein files and getting them to come out into the public. But you also see it too with the other expression of it here on the Democrat side, where these people who are winning their elections, who are running explicitly on an anti-AIPAC platform, on an anti-genocide platform, are saying we don't want to be controlled, right? So if people realize, like, well, wait a minute, we're leaving the party because we don't want to be controlled, and you're leaving the party because you don't want to be controlled, there is something there where people are saying we just want a government that we can trust again. And then we can debate the policy. And so a third force can be Thomas Massey running again in the Republican primary. It could be someone running in the Democratic primary. And it might be somebody like me running in the independent, you know, as an independent, not part of any established party whatsoever. And we're going to see different expressions of it in the country. And people should get ready, jump on board, because there's a new revolution coming. And what better year than this one and the 250th anniversary of the founding of our country?
Amazing. I want to thank our guests, Kazin and Jose. And I promise next time I will get your name perfectly right. Next time I have you on, I will practice it over and over and over and over again. And we will definitely get it pronounced from the very beginning. But tonight's conversation has been absolutely great because I think it is exactly what we need to be having in America today, at least having the dialogue. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Okay, speaking of the conversation, tonight's conversation actually forces Americans to think carefully about the direction this country is heading. You know, political parties evolve, ideas shift. Generations often challenge the system that they inherit. That is a part of democracy. But history also teaches us a very important lesson. Economic systems built on expanding government control rarely ever stop expanding. You see, the promise often begins with fairness, with equality, with security. But over time, something else happens. Government usurps it. It becomes larger. Individual freedoms, however, they become smaller. Dependence grows, innovation declines. And citizens increasingly surrender control over their own lives to political institutions. America has never been perfect. No free market system ever is. But one reason millions continue coming here from around the world is that America has something rewarded, something fundamental. They've rewarded them with freedom, opportunity, risk-taking, and personal responsibility. See, there's this ability to build your future through hard work rather than waiting for government permission. And that is why this political shift that is happening currently, it actually matters. Because what begins as policy experimentation in one city often grows into a national political identity. The question facing Democrats now is simple. Are they moving towards the future or towards an ideology history has repeatedly warned us about? See, the answer may shape American politics for decades to come. I want to thank my guests for joining us in this conversation, and thank you for watching. I'm Scottie Nell Hughes. Until next time.